It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says liberal cities, places like Madison, are among the worst places to live for people of color. We'll find out why. First up, Governor Walker and state Republican leaders announced yesterday that they plan to overhaul the state's civil service system. Supporters of these reforms say the system is due for an update after being created more than a century ago and to keep up with the large numbers of baby boomers that are set to retire soon. Sean Johnson joins us now. He's WPR's state government reporter. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So first of all, what is this thing, the civil service system? What does it do?
It is a system of protections that covers all state workers and was implemented more than a century ago as a good government reform. It is something we heard about more than we had maybe during the battle over the collective bargaining, for example, because when collective bargaining was brought up, a lot of people who were talking about making changes to collective bargaining would say, look, everybody's still covered by these civil service protections. So it's a wide array of protections that spell out everything from how you hire somebody to what it takes to fire somebody, with the goal of having the best people in the job.
And to disclaim here, you and I are both state employees. Hypothetically, changes would affect us in some way.
I'm not 100% certain
how
they would, actually, because we're a university, so I'm not sure if it carries over to us or not.
Okay. Well, what changes are planned here in these legislative changes to the civil service system?
Yeah, so the ones that they're kind of billing, the sponsors of this, first and foremost, are they're saying we need to have a faster hiring process. So they want to streamline the hiring process. They want to be able to hire somebody in 60 days. They say right now it takes between 116 days to 200 days at some agencies. They say that's too long. That if you have somebody, an agency that they really want to hire by that time, by the time they make an offer, that person might have already moved on. They also say that there's this civil service exam that gets issued right now that, in their words, is archaic. That nobody does this anymore, and that there should be instead more of a resume-based process. And I guess the common thread in all these is that sponsors say they want to move towards something more like you see in the private sector than what you have right now. So not only does it speed up the process for hiring somebody, it could also potentially speed up the process for firing them. So instead of having a 6-month probationary period where after somebody gets hired, they're on probation for 6 months, and after that 6 months, they're really more entrenched in their job, this would increase that probationary period to 2 years. It would also decrease the amount of time that somebody has in an appeal process. So a variety of ways where it tilts the playing field, which is right now in favor of the employee more, to more in favor of the employer, you know, the state agencies who are doing the hiring.
And also, I understand it would change or define further the concept of just cause for firing an employee.
Yes, right. So just cause, sponsors are saying that's sort of a nebulous term right now, and that just cause isn't really firmly defined. So they want to define that. That's another way where, that would give people more clarity of what they can and can't do on the job. But it also would spell out more clearly when somebody can be fired.
Talking to WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson about proposed changes in the state legislature to the state's civil service laws. State Senator Roger Roth is one of the bill's authors, and he argues here that the system needs updating.
Nobody does this anymore. So as we try to realign our hiring practices to the best practices we see in private business, in 2015, this is a thing of the past.
As you mentioned, Sean, trying to make it more like private business. Is this archaic system argument one of the main things you're hearing from the authors and sponsors?
Yeah, this is an issue that, the governor and Republican legislators really didn't talk about at all. And then all of a sudden, they're all talking about it in exactly the same way. So this is something that they, a talking point that they got down ahead of time. And, something that the governor drove home again today, speaking to reporters in Beaver Dam. He's saying that we're going to move this into the 21st century, that the old system is out of date. Nobody does this stuff anymore. I expect you're going to hear that a lot more as they push for these changes.
Democrats responding against this. So here's Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca.
Well, once again, we can see that Governor Walker and obviously his legislative allies are going to break their word to the people of Wisconsin.
So break their word to the people of Wisconsin. What is he getting at there?
He's getting at comments that Republicans made, and specifically the governor made really repeatedly as whenever civil service protections were discussed. So, you know, you go back to March of 2011, the governor was really pushing his collective bargaining bill. People were saying it was going to take away protections for workers, and he would say pretty much every time he was asked about it, no, it won't. Those are protected in civil service protections, which have been around a lot longer than collective bargaining. You know, he said those still strongly remain intact, that doesn't change. That was the point he made as he was pushing Act 10, is that they were leaving those alone. So here we are 4 years later, and, you know, they're obviously changing them.
As I understand it, when these laws were first put into place a century or so ago, one of the big problems that it was supposed to address was that a governor of either party might use government jobs as a reward for supporters, a sweet job, the government pay, getting them into the system. And that's what this is trying to get rid of. Have people been raising that as a concern, that patronage type jobs could make a comeback?
They have, yeah. I mean, that's something the Democrats have been saying, is that you're just going to open the door for this. I mean, I think you could go through and find hires that, you know, this governor has made, or then the previous governor made, where those hires were made because the people that were being put in those jobs were supporters. So it's not like it's squeaky clean now, but the argument that opponents of these changes are making is that you're essentially moving to a more subjective system that's going to move faster when it comes to hiring. So, you know, if you're a manager in state government and you don't have to follow the results of a test or give any weight to the results of a test, and you can just look at resumes, well, that's subjective. I mean, you can say, I like this person's resume better, and who's to argue? So, I mean, one of the things that the governor stressed today is, look, it's still going to be a merit-based system, and we're keeping all the good stuff, but the good stuff is going to be in the eye of the beholder, and we haven't even seen the bill yet.
We haven't seen the bill yet. So when do we expect to see the bill? Is there a sense that it's something that's going to move quickly?
Going to see the bill next week. It sounded like they wanted to move quickly. Anytime you have lawmakers and the governor and legislative leadership kind of on the same page on a big issue like this, basically hours after it's unveiled to the public, pretty good sense that they want to move in unison on this and that they're all on the same page. I mean, the legislators here said that they specifically thanked the governor for making state agencies available to them as they draft this legislation. So I think they're all on the same page here, and, you know, they don't need bipartisan support for this. So this could be an issue that we're talking about as the fall session unfolds.
One open question at the beginning of this week, after Governor Walker announced he was leaving the presidential race, was how he was going to get back into Wisconsin business, whether he'd hit the ground running. You saw him today in Beaver Dam. You see this new legislation on the way. Is this question being answered?
I think it is. He said that, you know, one of the ways that you kind of, you know, make a commitment to people is to be here. I mean, that's an acknowledgement that he hasn't been. So it was sort of like the pre-presidential run Walker today. He was touring a manufacturing plant, kind of projecting that image that he projected as a gubernatorial candidate. And now here he is talking about, you know, kind of his signature issue, which is changing state labor laws. So I would say that he is at this point in time, you know, invested in the job as governor.
Before we let you go, Sean, anything else you took away from seeing him speaking, say, in Beaver Dam?
He says that he doesn't want to take any kind of cabinet position, although he said when he was running for governor last year, he didn't want to run for president, and he ended up doing that. So yeah, I think that could be something that there could be some wiggle room for him on. I think he's definitely back in comfortable ground for him. He's not on the stump talking about foreign policy or anything like that. These are tried and true Walker, you know, speeches here today, and he's kind of back in his element.
Sean, thanks a lot, as always.
You're welcome.
That was WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson giving us the latest on a plan to change Wisconsin's civil service system. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As the nation has a conversation about race and equality of education and opportunity for people from minority communities, our next guest says progressive cities like Madison have a lot of work to do. In fact, he says cities that have a reputation for liberal politics, think places like Austin, San Francisco, and yes, Madison, are some of the worst places to be for African Americans and other people of color when it comes to racial disparities. Tim Wise is with us now. He's a national anti-racism educator and author. His new book is called Under the Affluence. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how are you?
Well, you say cities with progressive politics, Austin, Portland, Madison, some of the worst places to be for people of color. Why is that?
Well, I think there are objective reasons why, but I also know that it's just what I hear from black folks and folks of color generally whenever I speak to people in those areas. You know, these are people whose families oftentimes lived in the South, lived under the worst parts of segregation, and then they moved north or they moved west, perhaps to take advantage of industrial jobs and opportunities. But they will talk about how in many cases the racism that they experience, though it may not be as overt, it's almost worse because it's a form of invisibility, being looked through, being not seen, being treated as a sort of a constant outsider in places like Dane County. You know, we know that that is very clear. The biggest disparities between white arrest and black arrest for drugs, for instance, and incarceration rates for narcotics in the entire state of Wisconsin are in that county, a supposedly liberal, progressive place, where we know that there are white folks right now blazing up in dorm rooms at the University of Wisconsin who are not being suspected, not being detected, not being arrested. But lots of black folks are being suspected, detected, or profiled and arrested and incarcerated in that county and all throughout the state and all around the country. And not just in those, you know, reactionary places we might expect, but in these, you know, really sort of hip havens where everyone assumes that progressivism reigns. So it's both the data, but it's also the fact that black folks tell me that that's the case. They'll tell anyone willing to listen that that's the case. And I think it's probably valuable to believe them when they say that's it, that that is their experience.
Now, one might imagine, and maybe progressives in these places might imagine, that they would be the most racially enlightened white people in the country, that rooting out structural racism would be a top priority. Why do these objective measures and these perceptions run against their self-image?
Well, because I think white progressives oftentimes, you know, depending on where they're from, and I say this as a lifelong Southerner, I think white progressive folks who are from the South tend to have come through the lens of race to arrive at our politics. You know, if you're in the South and you're a progressive, you have to deal with race. I mean, it's in the foreground of everything that's happened in our region's history. But if you're white and you're from the Midwest, you're from the West Coast, the Pacific Northwest, the Northeast, you have the conceit and the luxury of believing that racism is just what us stupid yokels in the South do, and that somehow everybody else is more enlightened just because y'all were on the right side of the Civil War. And so I think what ends up happening is you have a lot of white progressives who are progressive because they have the right environmental policy politics, the right reproductive freedom politics, the right LGBT politics, the right anti-war politics. They're Bernie Sanders supporters from Vermont who have the right politics against the oligarchy and the wealthy and the elite. But if they didn't come up through an anti-racist lens, if they didn't have the benefit, frankly, of growing up in a place where the left was defined by civil rights and by the black liberation struggle, then even really well-intended white left folks and progressive folks can miss that piece, you know. And I think that's maybe the luxury of being from the South, is that, you know, I didn't have the benefit of being able to ignore race, and I don't think most white left Southerners have, but I think a lot of other folks, you know, have been able to miss that and sort of think about their progressivism with regard to every issue but race, and just assume that the rest would take care of race when in fact it doesn't.
Do you think that color blindness ends up being a goal then for those people who you say didn't grow up with that civil rights background as an immediate issue, but then that leads to blindness to issues of color?
Right. Well, absolutely. I mean, the two books ago, the book I wrote called Colorblind, and the subtitle of which was, you know, The Rise of Post-Racial Politics and the Retreat from Racial Equity, looks exactly at that. It's a critique of post-racial liberalism. You know, we think of conservative folks sometimes as being the ones who are trying to enforce colorblindness by saying, you know, oh, we shouldn't think about race, and we shouldn't have diversity initiatives, and we shouldn't have affirmative action. We should all be colorblind as a way to, you know, keep the lid on racial inequality. But in fact, there is a liberal version of that. I mean, even the president himself, as a man of color, has played into that back in 2004 when he gave the keynote address to the Democratic National Convention. The big applause line of that talk was the part where he said, you know, there's not a white America and a black America and a Latino America and an Asian America. There's just the United States of America. Well, that's utter nonsense. And it's such nonsense that I'm quite certain Barack Obama knew when he said it that it was nonsense. But he said it nonetheless because, of course, it was good politics. And yet it speaks to a truth that isn't true. We do, in fact, have multiple Americas based on racial cleavages. And this sort of notion that we can paper those over in the name of progressivism is no more logical than thinking we can paper them over in the name of some reactionary national Americanism. They're both, I think, bad ideas.
Talking to Tim Wise, an anti-racism educator, author of the book Under the Affluent, talking about cities known for progressive politics. He says, not great places for people of color to live. And Tim, in a recent piece where you were interviewed, you talked about talking to people, African-American people, mainly in places like Madison or San Francisco, who had left or were thinking of leaving. What kind of stories did you hear from them?
Well, the first time this ever happened was one of the first times I ever went to the Bay Area, you know, and I, growing up in Nashville, I mean, goodness, I thought that, you know, San Francisco and Oakland and places like that, and Portland were just nirvana, you know, because growing up in Nashville as someone on the left, you know, we had a hard time finding, you know, five liberal Democrats to put in a room, let alone people who were truly progressive or left. So I get out there and I'm sitting, talking, having coffee with the guy who I came to be friends with. And, you know, his thing was, look, this is the most racist place in many ways that I've ever lived. And he had lived in Birmingham, he'd lived in Dallas, I think he'd lived in the St. Louis area. You know, he lived in a lot of places that we think of as more racist. And when I asked him why that was, you know, he gave me the answer that, look, you know, it's in those places I know where I stand. In those places I know, he said, you know, who the enemy is, and I know how to avoid them, or I have strategies for dealing with them. But out here, I don't have that. And really, the Bay Area is a great example because, you know, white leftist and liberal and progressive folks think of San Francisco in the 60s and the Summer of Love and, oh, the hippies and Haight-Ashbury, and isn't that great? What they forget or maybe never knew is that at the very same time that white folks were, you know, all getting high and having a good time in the Haight, black folks in Oakland were being, you know, hassled by police. Black Panthers were being arrested. They were being beaten in the streets. It was never the summer of love for black folks in the Bay Area. But white progressives, you know, had the luxury of ignoring that while they were hanging out with the Grateful Dead and Janis Joplin or whatever else in San Francisco. So there's a real divide. And I think that's one of the reasons why black folks who've gone to these supposedly progressive places are moving back to the South, you know, because at least they say there, they know who the enemy is, and they sort of know what they're up against. So they're going to Charlotte, and they're going to Atlanta, you know, places like that. They're going to PG County outside of Washington, D.C. Now, those places still have issues, make no mistake. But they're the kind of issues that are familiar, and I think sometimes that's easier.
What would you like to see change? What's your prescription for maybe members of these communities we're talking about, white progressive communities in these cities, and for urban leaders in those areas?
I think that white progressives in those areas need to acknowledge that there is no liberatory politics. There is no truly progressive politics possible in this country that is not anti-racist. If you are a progressive activist type, but you don't think and talk about race in everything you do, if you're a health reform activist, an educational reform activist, and, you know, a Bernie Sanders supporter who talks about, you know, economic justice, if you're an ecology and environmental activist, an anti-war activist, and you're not, if you're a food security activist talking about the availability of good, safe and healthy foods, and you're not talking about, you know, food deserts and the way they affect people of color disproportionately and the racial justice aspect of that, then you're not doing your job. There is no progressive politics possible in a country like the United States, which has never been a white country. It is certainly increasingly not a white country that is not anti-racist. And so I would say we have to inculcate and put in to all of our movements an anti-racist lens. As for urban leaders, I think they have to have real serious conversations, whether it's mayors or city councils, school boards, et cetera, about how to bring a racial justice frame to everything from housing policy to zoning policy to transportation policy. You know, if you're going to have communities that are gentrifying, you're going to have fair housing initiatives. You're going to have to ensure that the people of color who live in places like North Portland, before North Portland got hip and had Pilates studios and yoga mats and coffee shops, you know, there are a lot of low-income black folks who live there who are being pushed out. Their rent's driven past the point of affordability. Their property taxes going through the roof. They can't pay them because they're on fixed incomes, many of them elderly. There's got to be some protection for the people who were in the neighborhood before it became hip. And that's what I think urban leaders have to think about if they really want to bring about justice.
Briefly, are you seeing communities starting to have those conversations?
Well, I think some are. There are some communities. Minneapolis is trying to do this. Their mayor is trying to get out front and really talk about white supremacy and white privilege. I don't know that she'll be around long, keep talking about stuff like that, but I certainly like the effort that she's making, and I think it really speaks to these issues. The National League of Cities is doing some really good work right now around racial justice initiatives and undoing racism in cities around the country. I've been in Baltimore all week. They're certainly having these conversations in the wake of the April uprising. So I think there are conversations, but ultimately, you know, we can't leave those conversations to black and brown folks to engage. Those of us who are white and claim to be progressive and left, we've got to be challenging our brothers and sisters in our own communities about these things and making sure that we understand the importance of racial justice to the larger issue of economic and social justice.
Tim, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
It's Tim Lies, anti-racism activist, author, and educator. His latest book is called Under the Influence. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. It's officially fall, and here in Wisconsin, it means we're headed toward the end of the growing season. But there are some easy ways to enjoy the remaining summer bounty well into the winter. Not just canning and freezing now, our guest says, but drying our produce. Teresa Maroney is the author of The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. Preserve fresh fruits, vegetables, herbs, and meat with a dehydrator, a kitchen oven, or the sun. She joins us today from North Shore Community Radio, WTIP, in Grand Marais, Minnesota. Teresa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
First question, why? Why dry?
Well, there's a number of reasons that you might want to do that. As you mentioned, this is a great time to preserve the harvest. And actually, now is a better time to dehydrate than earlier in the summer because our kitchens aren't quite so hot. And we save money by doing it. And another really big reason that people don't think about is for specialized diets, people that want to avoid sulfites, gluten that's so common in a lot of food. When you make your own dried foods, you can eliminate all of those things and virtually all of the dried fruits in particular that you buy at the store have sulfite in them. And that causes a lot of people problems. So when you dry your own, you just don't have to use them. So that's a pretty good reason too.
What's the principle here? With freezing, I get it, it's cold, so bacteria grow more slowly. With canning, you cook the heck out of it, in effect, and kill all the stuff. Why does drying keep food, help it last longer?
Well, drying is actually the oldest method of preservation because if you think about what people had before refrigeration or electricity, they had dried foods. This is what they've been doing since the Stone Age. And the way that it works is that we're removing the majority of the water in the food, which gives the bacteria very little to grow on. So it's not that it's sterile, but it's just an inhostile environment for bacteria.
Let's get to the how. And there's different ways, different machinery. Most people are going to have an oven available to them. I understand that's not the ideal method, but it might be a good way to start. How does it work?
Okay, the oven is the way that most people will start because most people have one. And what I recommend people try first is drying some apples. It's real easy to do. It's a product you're familiar with. If you mess it up, you haven't spent a lot of money on something. And basically what you want to do is you have to have your oven probably about as low as it would go. 150 is pretty much the maximum temperature you want to dehydrate at. And a lot of modern ovens go to that temperature. Older ones kind of don't, so it's a little bit of a problem if you've got one of those. But if you have a modern one, you can crank it to 150 or lower, keep the doors slightly open, and direct a little fan in there, which pushes the air around, and then the moisture will also come out through the other side of the open oven door. So that's how we do it.
So circulation is a key no matter the method, it sounds like, because if you're getting the moisture out, but it's just enclosed in an oven with all the stuff, some of it's going to go back in.
That's absolutely right. And a lot of, when people do get into purchasing dehydrators, there's a lot of really cheap entry-level models that don't have a fan. Those aren't even worth buying because all it's doing is heating the food and the moisture can't escape. So the better dehydrators, and I'm not talking about super expensive ones, just the good ones that you'd want to buy, have a little fan unit in them and the air circulates around, blows over the food, and blows out the top.
And it sounds like if we get the dehydrating bug and we really want to do a lot of stuff, the only way to go is to get one of those dehydrators or make one. You have instructions on making our own.
I do have instructions on making one. It's a kind of a bulky thing. It works really well. The plans in the book that I have make a fantastic dehydrator. Old plans that you see for homemade dehydrators all rely on incandescent light bulbs, which, as you know, are being phased out. So my plans rely on some other technology, which is kind of a newer style of being able to make that. But it's certainly easiest to get into a decent entry-level dehydrating system. You can get one for about $50, which isn't too bad.
It's got to have a fan. No fan, don't bother.
Got to have a fan. No fan, no ticky, no washy.
Now, some people love the sun-dried tomatoes you can get at the store. How is the sun really an option in a place like Wisconsin for much of the year?
You know, really, it isn't. We just don't have enough reliable sun. Plus, it's too humid here. I mean, the Midwest is intensely humid. And most commercially dried fruit that you buy is done in California in the sun. Like raisins really are made in the sun. Sun-made raisins really are made in the sun. But it's not humid out there. And they have abundant sun, high temperatures. They have everything they need. Here in the Midwest, our food would tend to spoil because it's so humid, even when it's hot. In the summer, it's humid, and it just doesn't work.
We're talking to Teresa Maroney, author of The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. And she's giving us some advice on not just making dried foods, but using it in our cooking. Let's get into a little of that, Teresa. You mentioned those apples as a good starting point, and you gave us a recipe for crumb-topped dried apple pie. That's up on the Central Time Facebook page. Talk us through that recipe.
Oh, that's a wonderful thing to try. It's kind of an old-fashioned recipe, and it's not like a big high apple pie that you're used to because the fruit is dry. It does rehydrate, but it remains a little bit flat. It's more like you'd think of the filling in a pastry or something like that. It has an intense apple flavor. It's really a wonderful pie. I've heard some people don't like it. I think it's way better than standard apple pie. And basically, you're just taking dried apples, and you can dry your own, or you can actually buy apples and do this too if you want to try it. And you're rehydrating them a little bit, putting them in a pie crust, putting a crumb topping on, and baking it. So it's fairly straightforward, except that you're starting with a dried product.
When I think of drying, all I've ever dried at home is fruit, apples, and I think pears. But you've got a lot of vegetables going on here. What are good vegetables to start with for people who want to start drying at home?
Well, right now the best... Yeah, right now, I think you cut out for a minute there. Right now the best vegetables are the things that are in season. Squash is fantastic to dry. That works really well. Winter squash, pumpkins, that kind of squash are really great to dry. Cabbage, surprisingly, dries really well. Something else that dries really well that's in season right now, and people don't think of this, is eggplant. And it's one of the foods that's actually improved quite a bit by dehydrating. Because if you slice eggplant and dehydrate it, then when you rehydrate it, it doesn't have that kind of slimy, soft texture that cooked eggplant often has. It stays a little bit firmer, which is really nice.
If we're drying eggplant, or I think you mentioned zucchini in the book too, are these things, you know, I could just eat dried apples, right? Can I just munch on dried zucchini and eggplant?
Dried zucchini you certainly can, and in fact that's the best thing to do with it, because if you rehydrate zucchini that's been dried, it's going to be pretty darn soft. I mean, it's going to seem overcooked. So actually the way that a lot of people do zucchini and cucumbers, they slice it maybe a quarter inch thick and dehydrate it, and then they use it as a substitute for like a vegetable chip. It's crisp but not crunchy. It's not like a potato chip because it's not fried, but they're nice with dip, and they're nice on salads, and they're nice for snacking. Dried squash pumpkins and things like that, winter squash, would be pretty chewy. It certainly wouldn't hurt you to eat it, but I don't think you'd like it all that well. But that is really fabulous to cook with. And you can, for example, mash some cooked pumpkin and dehydrate that in a layer and then just keep it at room temperature. And when you want to make a pie, you just rehydrate it with a little bit of warm water, and it's way better than canned pumpkin. Really good.
Another recipe you gave us brings a slow cooker into the equation. You've got a slow cooker pork chops with root vegetables. First, tell us about drying those root vegetables. I think there are turnips involved there, and then cooking them back up in the slow cooker.
The slow cooker is actually ideal for that because it gives the long, slow rehydration that really makes the vegetables taste fantastic, and they're very tender when you do that. There's also dried apples in that one, and that's a super easy thing. You've just dried slices of parsnips or rutabagas or turnips or whatever you want, basically, and then you layer it into a crock pot with some pork chops and some onion and the vegetables and some liquid, and plug her in, and you're done. It's really very easy. It's really satisfying and really good.
We're talking to Teresa Maroney. She is the author of The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. Preserve fresh fruits, vegetables, herbs, and meat with a dehydrator, a kitchen oven, or the sun. And we want to hear from you. Have you done this? Do you dry fruits and veggies? What's your setup? What kind of gear do you use? Do you have a favorite way to use those dried foods? Have you ever tried to dry food and it didn't come out quite right? Maybe Teresa can troubleshoot for you. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email talk at WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Check out some Food Friday recipes while you're there. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation about drying foods, how to dry them, and then how to cook with them. We have Teresa Maroney with us. She's the author of The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your success stories or failure stories. You can also post at the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a few recipes from Teresa posted there. We'll go right to our callers. Anne is with us in Wautoma. Anne, hi.
Hi. I'm calling to ask if I could put a fan either next to or over my dehydrator. I just received it as a gift, but it does not have a fan in it.
Oh, interesting. Any luck there, Teresa? Can she just put an external fan there?
It depends on what type of setup it is. You have to be able to direct the food sort of across, the fan, the air, across the food while not getting it entirely out of the warm air. So with most of the dehydrators that you can buy that have a fan, is a stacking series of trays that's on a base that produces both heat and air. So the air and the heat both blow through simultaneously. So depends on the design of your dehydrator. If it's like if it's got an open side that you could direct a fan into that wouldn't disrupt the heat too much, yeah, I think you could try it. It's certainly worth a try. The other thing you can do, depending on what you have, you could use those racks in your oven if you have an oven that goes low enough. One of the hardest things people encounter when trying to make a homemade dehydrator is, what am I going to use for a rack? And it sounds like you've already got some racks, so you're kind of heads up on that one.
And good luck. And Teresa, are there any things that might do better in that fanless dehydrator than others? Any fruits or vegetables that you might be safer with?
I would certainly never try to dehydrate something like jerky in a thing like that, because that jerky is one of the harder things to do from a food safety standpoint. It has to be done fairly hot, and you really do need to keep that air moving before it spoils. I would try things that can handle higher heat, which would be fruits. We want to dehydrate our fruits at like 135 typically. We want to dehydrate vegetables at 125, a lower temperature, and we want to dehydrate herbs at about 100. So I would go with something that could handle a little bit more heat and is less likely to spoil, which would be fruits. The natural sugars in fruits prevent spoilage.
Anne, thanks a lot for that call, and good luck. 800-642-1234 is the number. Gabrielle in Viroqua is with us now. Gabrielle, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up?
Well, I had two ideas that I wanted to share. One was when you have the dried zucchini, and I guess you could do it with other vegetables as well, other items. When I dry zucchini, I dry it really crisp, and then I powder it, and I use it as a thickening agent in soups and things like that, and just adds nutrients and doesn't change the flavor too much. So I find that a really nice.
That's a great idea. That's something I do too. That's really a good idea.
Yeah, it's a really, really nice way to use up a lot of zucchini,
which we tend to get
a lot of, right?
Yes, it is.
And then I have a really nice recipe for what I call crunchies. I soak raw sunflower seeds, shelled, and I soak them for a few hours. Then I drain the water and sprout them just a little bit. And then I put them on dehydrator trays, and I salt them, or I put turmeric or curry or anything else on them, and I dehydrate them overnight, and they are a really nice, healthy snack.
Interesting. That sounds excellent. What temperature do you do that at, Gabrielle?
I keep it really low.
Pretty low.
I like things in my dehydrator done at 110 or lower, generally,
but
I'm sure they can be done higher, and then I just leave them overnight. So I just turn my dehydrator on overnight, and in the morning I have these lovely crunchies. I've done it with other nuts and seeds too, but the best is sunflower seeds.
Gabrielle,
that
thanks.
Just sounds great.
That does, Gabrielle. Thanks for sharing that with us. And that reminds me, she mentioned pre-treating those sunflower seeds, soaking them in this case. You write, Teresa, that a lot of different vegetables need some kind of pre-treatment, often blanching, hitting them in boiling water. Why do they need that? What needs that pre-treatment?
What that's doing, it's the same thing that you do to vegetables before you freeze them. You give them a quick blanch in steam or in boiling water, and it stops some of the bacterial action that causes decay. It's the exact same thing you do when you freeze. You can dehydrate without doing this, but the vegetables will darken and will begin to deteriorate more quickly. They'll be tougher. And they'll be a little bit less enjoyable to eat. But back in the old days, people did it without blanching all the time. So you certainly can do it. You just get a better, kind of softer product that rehydrates better and doesn't turn dark so much, just the same as with freezing.
Talking to Teresa Maroney about drying foods. She's the author of The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. She covers fruits, vegetables, herbs, meats, everything you could dry. She talks about it in her book, and you could still join in at 800-642-1234. Nathan is with us in Waukesha now. Nathan, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling with a personal experience. A couple of years ago when I was in school, my roommate found a way to build your own dehydrator. So we made our own jerky by getting a box that was maybe, I don't know, 12 by 12 by 15 inches and hanging pieces of meat off of shish kebab sticks, cutting a hole in the bottom, cutting a hole in the top, and putting an incandescent bulb on the bottom and just letting convection move the air.
And how long did it take till you had edible jerky, Nathan?
About 3 days.
And was this in a dorm or an apartment?
Apartment at the time.
Okay.
In hindsight, it wasn't the best idea, but nobody got sick, and it worked out pretty well.
Well, good, good. Nathan, thanks so much. So it's something you can do, but as he said, nobody got sick. Got to be maybe a little extra careful with meat, trying to make jerky, Teresa.
Yeah, and, you know, you would want to be sure of the source of your meat, be sure that it's fresh quality meat. I certainly would not do that with poultry or fish, but with beef you could probably, or venison, you could probably get away with that. And that's very similar, well, obviously back in the old days, cavemen didn't have boxes and shish kebab skewers and stuff like that, but it's very similar to air drying that has been done for centuries, and it would be probably quite chewy done that way, but it would probably be pretty good.
All right, college ingenuity. Back to our callers now with Scott on the line in Rockford. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I have one of those round dehydrators that has a fan, and I tried making beef jerky, and the bottom layer, like, dried out really, really tough. And the top layer was, like, kind of soft and better, but it's not even. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions on that.
Yeah, I'll give you a tip on that. The round dehydrator you're talking about is probably like the American Harvester Snack Master or something like that. That's a very typical one, and I use one of those myself all the time. And the instructions will tell you that you don't have to rotate the racks, and that is not true. You do. So what I do is when I'm doing something, especially something like jerky that's going to be drying for a pretty long time, I'll set a timer for at the beginning once an hour and then once every 2 hours, and I'll take the top rack off, I'll put it on the table, I'll pick up the stack, I'll put the top rack on the bottom position, and then put the stack back on. So I'm rotating the racks through the position, if you know what I mean, once an hour at the beginning and then every 2 hours once things are starting to go. And that will make all the trays receive even heat, because if you didn't do that, that bottom tray just got toasted and the top tray was getting the air and moisture blowing over it, so it wasn't getting adequately dried. And as I say, the instructions always say you don't have to rotate them, and with that type of dehydrator, you do.
Scott, good luck. I hope that helps, and bring some by next time you're in our area. We'll go next to Gabriel in Chicago. Gabriel, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us?
I have a surplus of plums from the summer harvest. And I'm wondering the best way to prepare or make plum dessert, maybe with a dried plum dessert. Do you have any suggestions?
So you've already dried them?
No, they're not dried yet.
Oh, you have to dry them. Okay. With plums, you want to cut them in half to get the pit out, of course. And if they're small, you can just dry them the way that they are. They are not like commercial prunes. I mean, prunes are plums, but when you dry your own, they're kind of, your own will be a lot better than that.
And let's leave them, we're just about out of time, Therese, but leave them with a tip for a recipe once he gets those dried up.
I would throw them together in a pan and with a little bit of hot water to rehydrate them and make a cobbler out of them. That's what I love to do with them.
So you just get those lumps of dough and drop them in? Great.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yep.
Teresa, before we let you go, briefly, what's your next drying project?
Oh, I'm still working on some fall things like squash and pumpkins and kale, making kale chips.
Ooh.
And making some snack chips and things like that. So it's kind of fun.
Sounds fantastic. Teresa, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed talking with you.
That was Teresa Maroney. She is the author of The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. Preserve fresh fruits, vegetables, herbs, and meat with a dehydrator, a kitchen oven, or the sun. Except we learned not so much the sun here in Wisconsin. She joined us today from North Shore Community Radio, WTIP, in Grand Marais, Minnesota. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We have three recipes, including dried green tomatoes. Didn't get to talk about that, but you can check it out and give it a try. Today is the 85th anniversary of the birth of Shel Silverstein, poet, children's book author, musician, lyricist, playwright, and cartoonist. I'm guessing he's one of the very few people who have drawn illustrations for Playboy and to have written massively influential books for kids. The Giving Tree was one of his most famous books. Kind of a weird message in that one, I always thought, but my favorite was Where the Sidewalk Ends. I remember in, let's call it, say, fourth grade or so, memorizing poems from that book and having to recite them in front of the class. It's up there in my childhood memories with, you know, Dr. Seuss, The Phantom Toll Booth. I don't think I could recite those poems anymore, though. Silverstein wrote lyrics for some big-name performers, the songs made famous by artists like Dr. Hook and The Medicine Show, you know, the cover of The Rolling Stone, he wrote that one, Kris Kristofferson and Waylon Jennings. Probably most famously, as we go to the news, Johnny Cash. This is Central Time.
Well, my daddy left home when I was three. Didn't leave very much to my mom and me except this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that my daddy ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. He must have thought that it was quite a joke, and I got a lot of laughs from a lot of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd turn red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. But I grew up quick and I grew up mean. My fists got hard, my wits got keener. Roamed from town to town to hide my shame.